Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you can listen. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and Jason Croft is our technical director. If you've ever set foot on an airport tarmac out there where the airplanes go, you know that it is not a place for human beings. Things are whizzing by big metal boxes, trucks, and of course, airplanes. It's a very uncomfortable feeling. Probably not too many of us have actually done that. But if you've ever broken down on an interstate highway and had to leave your car and walk somewhere to get to help, you also know that sort of helpless feeling that this is not a place designed for human beings. It's very uncomfortable just having your own body out there. Well, a lot of our cities kind of feel like those places, unfortunately, and a lot of people are, you know, kind of concerned about what we do about that. Our places are not really walkable. And so the topic of the show today is walkable communities, what it takes to design them, what it would take to return to a more human-scale sort of urban landscape. Our guest is someone who has been dealing with these issues for a long time. Dan Burden is founder and executive director of Walkable Communities Incorporated. He's the former state bicycle and pedestrian coordinator for the state of Florida, which sounds like a great job. He's also a nationally recognized expert on bicycle and pedestrian facilitation programs. He has 25 years' experience in developing, promoting, and evaluating transportation facilities, traffic calming practices, and sustainable community development. He is in Champaign-Urbana to give a couple of workshops that we will mention during this hour because they are free and open to the public. In fact, he will be speaking tonight at the Champaign, Illinois Terminal Building, 45 East University Avenue in Champaign, speaking about walkable communities. And that'll be a sort of an overview public presentation. If you'd like to attend, you are welcome to do so. He'll also be giving more extended workshops on the 20th. That'd be tomorrow and Saturday. And those require registration, so and it's kind of an all-day thing. If you'd like to attend, you need to call the MTD at 384-8188. I'll give that information out again later, so don't worry if you didn't write that down. And he's here to talk with us about walkable communities. If you'd like to join our conversation, all you have to do is call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening on the web, anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. And our guest joins us here in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Jack.
Let me ask you to start out. How did you get into this business of looking at what it would take to design walkable communities?
Well, a number of things. Back when I was totally into bicycling in a very big way professionally, I decided to take a trip to Australia. I actually was invited there, and as I was walking down the many beautiful streets in each of their towns, I realized that was what my whole youth had been about. I owned the towns. I grew up in the Midwest, Central Ohio. And that they had taken a different path, that they kept their cities in a design for their people. And they allowed the car to have a space, but they didn't dominate the space. So I came back and just changed my title from state bicycle coordinator to state bicycle and pedestrian coordinator. Nobody complained. And it started a new following. That was way back in 1991. And now when I started that, it was about 86. Mm-hmm. But by 91, they made it a federal law that all states had to have both a bicycle and a pedestrian coordinator. And I want to say that my walk began in earnest around 1996. I've been walking through about 1,400 communities in America, just go from town to town. And it's all based on people realizing that we forgot ourselves in our towns, and it's time to reclaim the territory and the space and to make our towns alive and whole and livable.
Now, you said there's a federal law that every state has a bicycle and pedestrian coordinator. Illinois has a bicycle and pedestrian coordinator?
They do. Now, some states take it very seriously, yeah. and they hire the best person they can get, and they give them full license mm-hmm. to change. Others say, we're not going to change a darn thing, and they make sure they put a person in that post that doesn't do a really effective job. There are only about six or eight states that take it real seriously.
Okay. Well, I didn't know about that, so that's news to me. So you go through the you just walk through the community, and that's how you get a sense of what it's like.
Right, and people teach me in each community. I have many great mentors, whether they be architects, landscape architects, engineers, planners, economists. So every town I go to, I'm getting basically free education and being paid for it. By the greatest of people. Recently, my wife and I took a walk in Vancouver, B.C., one of the best cities in North America.
I was just there.
Oh, were you?
Okay. Yeah, in August, yeah.
Yeah, and the fellow who's designing the whole new waterfront village for the Olympics showed us his design before he even showed it to the client and spent the morning walking us around, showing us how this new city would evolve.
That's tremendous. Yeah, there's an incredible park there. I'm trying, for some reason, the name is escaping me.
But Stanley.
Stanley Park, yes, of course, that has, you know, great walking trails and bicycling trails, and they've got, there's a horse-drawn carriage and stuff and all that stuff. And it's just, it's amazing. Until you see it, you go, how could, this exists in a city?
Yeah. And I think that's the important thing. Vancouver, B.C. chose not to build any freeways. Well, they tried and they failed. They did such a bad, brutal job of trying to carve up a Chinese cultural community that they just got stopped cold in their tracks. The net result is of not having built the freeway system is they made major investments in their transit, in walking, in bicycling, their waterfronts, the compact, dense urban form. And it truly is one of the greatest cities in all of North America, if not in the world, because they didn't build their freeway system.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So you've seen a lot of different communities. And what are the kinds of, say it's in a Midwestern communities. I don't know, is there a typical Midwestern community? What are the kinds of things that you see?
Well, first of all, I love the Midwest. I grew up in Central Ohio. To me, the Midwest is going to be one of the slowest on the uptake of what it's going to take to revitalize itself and build walkable communities. And one reason it's going to be hard is a lot of the Midwest is already good. And so when you get the kinds of damage of shopping plazas and strip development, it's like, well, there's still some good solid cores in each community, so people aren't noticing that they're out there destroying the things that would matter. So I think it's going to take a little longer. I consider Chicago and now Columbus, Ohio, as the two lead cities in the Midwest, and many of the others are going to take a little longer to figure out what they're losing and to start the recovery process.
It's interesting. You use the phrase not noticing what they're destroying. Every community is concerned about economic development, partially because the schools are based on the tax base.
Right.
And, the school funding issue is a big one for everybody. So we're all interested in generating more revenue to fund the basic services like education and everything else. So we're looking for the big box stores,
right?
And the strip malls and all that stuff. And in that rush, maybe we forget a few things.
Well, actually, we end up forgetting a lot of things. And one of the secrets of the good city of the future is we've got to stop building the biggest of things. A big school just destroys all kinds of community, a big recreation center, a big store, a big fire station, anything. We've got to get back down to the neighborhood scale. We've got to be building many villages. Every town, say, of a population of 30,000 or so, would have at least a dozen villages, just the way we used to do trolley car stops, where everything within a five-minute walk is pretty compact. You've got all of your needs being met in that place, some medicals, some retail, civic, open space, but lots of great housing in toward that center. And then as you get further out, you lighten the density a little bit, and a place like Urbana or Champaign would have dozens of those villages over time. And guess what? Some of the places that have been destroyed, the shopping plazas, will convert beautifully to these new villages.
Mm-hmm. Do we see that happening in places?
Yes. I say there are two cities to watch in America right now because they're doing so many things very good. One is Sacramento, California, where the circus is going on. and the other is Charlotte, North Carolina. Mm. And I like both examples, not because they're already there, because they're working very hard. Their school boards are talking to their politicians. They're planning boards are being trained. Their engineers are being trained. Their architects get it. Their developers get it. And they're working together. They're building light rail and building villages at each light rail station, things like that. And these are the things that are going to matter in the end, is having everybody work together. Not, you know, all it takes is like the school board being totally independent, going off and doing their thing for their needs, and further destroying the big community. Because as you recognize, you build one big school somewhere and everybody wants to live near that good school, all of a sudden you've induced another type of sprawl that we can't afford.
Oh, very interesting. Well, you mentioned the idea of getting everybody working together. It seems that that's one of the key things that has to happen.
It absolutely has to. And I think, in a sense, that's why the Canadians or the Australians or New Zealanders are so far ahead of us, is they've learned how to work together. We, with all of our freedoms in our country, we fail to accept our responsibilities. And therefore, we've allowed ourselves to degrade much, much, much more rapidly. And along with that, America is considered, if not the top country for consumerism and not just personal freedom, but the amount of money we have. We have lost our quality of life. We're now ranked about 38th in the world for quality of life. And it's because we haven't paid attention to the responsibilities of building good stuff and working together to build that good stuff. We've just lost it, and we've got to start regaining it. And it turns out that something as simple as walkability becomes the finite test as to whether or not a place is livable or not.
That's very interesting. Well, we talked about, you mentioned some of the sort of like village centers that sort of some of the key components. What are some of the other things that determine whether a community is walkable?
Well, a lot of good connectivity. If we have the original grid pattern of a town where the streets were laid out nicely and you have lots of connections, that is absolutely essential. If you go to an area that got built later, built for the car, where we don't have many connections, it's hard to walk. Mm-hmm. You know, even if we had sidewalks and trees and crossings, you just have to go vast distances just to get to your friend's house one block over, because you have to go way down and then way back up or something like that. So repairing the broken pieces by putting those connections in that never were made before, that's important. And or next time we plan a village, to have the right pattern so that we get that good fine grain mesh. That's one. Another one is, it truly is all about mixing the uses. We have to put things back together again. Having one type of land use, like housing's totally isolated from workplaces, from churches, from schools, from parks, it just doesn't make any sense. We have to get in a car to do everything we do. And then, of course, to build the buildings to the street, to build that beautiful urban form where you actually have joy in walking along a street, not looking at somebody's gray asphalt parking lot and wondering why you're even on the walk, you know. And there are dozens more. By the way, anyone who would like to, they can go to our website and upload a good list. It's I think it's referred to as the 12 Steps Toward Walkable Communities. Just www.walkable.org.
Very simple. How big a role does green space play?
Green space is absolutely essential. And having the right amount of green in places is important. And again, if we build a single park or several parks way too big, we end up driving to them. Mm-hmm. It's important to have open space within 1/8 mile of every house. Mm. And that's one of the measures of quality of life.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, people will take ownership of anything within 800 or 900 feet of their own home. They'll watch over it, they'll care for it, and they'll go there. But if you put it, say, 2,000 feet from their house, they probably won't walk there. They don't think it's theirs, and it doesn't really get cared for the way it needs to. So not only having the green space, but how we orchestrate it and what size it is matters a lot.
It's interesting that people will have a sort of a instinctive reaction to space. If it's uncomfortable, they just won't go there.
And, you know, it's so interesting. And part of my presentation is the heart tells us what to build. The heart tells us what not to build. And so if we take a walk through anybody's community and fall in love with anything, we take a mental picture of that, and then we come back and we see if that's possible, in our own neighborhood or in our own downtown or something like that. Things like public art, the style, the rhythm, the pattern of buildings, of the streets. You know, there's a great book by Christopher Alexander called The Timeless Way of Building, and another one he wrote, Pattern Language, which anyone who's interested in anything about a town should read both those books. And it's absolutely true. Throughout the history of mankind, the things that really matter have ended up in that book as a pattern or a way of building that applies to everything we ever build.
Very interesting. Public art. And Seattle has a program in public art. They sort of, you know, people are invited to actually paint the bus stops and that kind of thing.
Great stuff.
I don't know if Seattle is a great example of a walkable community. Parts of it are.
Yeah. Well, actually, Seattle is one of the top vote getters for a livable community. I think if you look consistently, they are the top livable community on most votes. And for a lot of good reasons. First of all, they have great neighborhood planning. They have, I think it's something like 43 neighborhoods. Every neighborhood puts together its own vision, its own plan. So anytime the city has some money to spend, they can go right down the list and start building what the neighborhoods want. Seattle is so well built that today, whenever they do new housing starts, none of them are occurring in the neighborhoods. They're already built out. And anything that gets built now has to be mixed use. And so like right now in downtown Seattle, they have 20,000 permits pulled for building new residential units. And out of the rest of all the neighborhoods, only two per month.
How about that? So that's an issue of planning and zoning. The city intentionally made it that way.
Exactly. And what I like to say is the towns that are making it start with a vision. Until there's a vision, there is no hope that you'll ever end up doing the right thing. You have to have some concrete language that everybody is focused on, that they see. And once you identify what that vision of the neighborhood is, everybody now, no matter what the issue is, a parking lot or something, this doesn't fit our vision. Or twist it this way, and then it's going to match the vision of this neighborhood.
We have a call to include in our conversation. Let's do that. And let me just mention again, we're talking with Dan Burden. He's founder and executive director of Walkable Communities, Inc. He's in Champaign-Urbana to give a couple of workshops on walkable communities, and that's what we're talking about. If you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's go to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I thought it was really interesting that Mr. Burden said 900 feet, because that's exactly how far we are from our park. I've measured that before, and that's exactly why I feel like we own it and we're part of that.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of comments about cars and bikes. That, by the way, we're really lucky to live in this in the Champaign-Urbana area. I think it's really very, walkable, and I feel like we're really lucky. On the other hand, there's still too many cars, and they're always bringing more cars in all the time. And it seems like cars are subsidized. You know, if people actually had to pay at the pump for building highways, it would probably be spending $5 or $8 a gallon.
Right.
And that would be a way to... Wait, I'm on the radio. I'm a full-time father, so that's part
great.
Of why I really appreciate a walkable community. And the other thing that I was going to say about I'm on the radio. Everybody in the whole walkable community can hear you. The other thing is about you seem to have some involvement with bikes and policy for bikes. And often you get these pamphlets that will talk about, you know, the right way to fit your helmet and stay on the left side or the right side of the road and to use the hand signals and so on. But they never really... they don't seem really very real world. And one of the best ways, I think, to think of that is to imagine a left turn for a bicycle in almost any community in America.
Yeah.
How can, you know, so I think the left turn gets avoided in those pamphlets. And if every community could think about the real safe way for a bike to make a legal left turn that's not going to get everybody mad. You know, it's a really hard thing to think about. In England, it would be a right turn because they're on the different side of the road. But in America, it would be left turn for a bike. It's a very, very difficult thing. And I guess I'll hang up and let you talk. Oh, by the way, in Stanley Park, the other thing is, there is they have the huge trees, so maybe that's part of the walkable community.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll hang up.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the big thing about bicycle lane and the way motorists are behaving around bicyclists is that the more active we create a bicycling culture and community, the more motorists have a friend, a child, a parent that rides a bike, the more courteous they become. We have found that it's really truly about numbers. Once you reach a certain threshold of the number of people who ride bikes, all of a sudden everybody starts to pay attention to them, watch over them.
Wow.
Davis, California, for example, was a fairly large community, about 100, 120,000 population, has only had one fatality in 21 years. And it's largely because everybody rides bikes in Davis. And so even though the roads are fast and this and that, they're really on guard and they're watching out and looking out for the needs of the bicyclist. And I think the same is exactly true of walking. The more people walk, the safer it becomes for everybody.
The thing about bicycling that has really struck me is, you know, I ride a bicycle and I drive a car. When I'm riding a bicycle, sometimes cars go whizzing past me on the left, rather close, and I feel like, what's the matter with this driver? Don't they understand that, you know, they're basically endangering my life with their, you know, the way that they're passing me? And when I'm in a car and I'm passing a bicyclist, I sometimes find myself thinking, what's the matter with this bicyclist? Don't they understand that I can't just swerve around them?
Yeah.
And this is one of, you know, it's almost inevitable if the streets are not, or the bike, there's no bike paths, there's no actual bike route, there's no way for us to coexist without that kind of conflict.
Right. The challenge of building a system for bicycle lane is that once we've started to have built out a community, there's only one choice for where to be. We just simply, unlike Europe, we don't have the ability to fit in a pathway system. We can on a campus, we can in certain parts of a town, and that needs to be part of the way we look at it, but we really have to design on-road facilities. And except for a number of Western states, the Midwest and the East has not built good bike lanes anywhere. We just have neglected it, and yet they fit in beautifully. In fact, one of the approaches we take to making a neighborhood civil again is to take like collector roads and sometimes the principal roads and narrow them down to 10-foot lanes. We can get about a 7-mile-an-hour speed reduction on most streets when we take the lanes down from being oversized or fat and trim off that excess and then put that space into bike lanes. And everybody behaves better. In fact, there are 22 benefits of bike lanes. Only 2 are for the bicyclist. Most of them are benefits to the motorist.
How about that? Well, our lines are all full. I've got more questions, but I'll defer to the callers. We'll go next to someone in the Chicago area on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello?
Yes.
Very interesting program. I didn't catch the name of the book that you suggested that had a lot of this basic information. Could you repeat that?
Sure. 2 books. They're both by Christopher Alexander. The first one is called Timeless Way of Building. And the second,
Timeless Way of Building?
A building.
Uh-huh.
And the second is Pattern Language.
Pattern Language.
Language. And don't let the size of them frighten you. They're fun reads. Each one's over 1,000 pages.
Uh-huh.
But they're just absolutely a joy to read. I actually took Pattern Language to Europe with me, and each day my daughter and I would read a chapter and only photograph what was in that chapter.
Huh.
It's a wonderful, wonderful way to learn.
Now, you have a website, but you don't have a book at this point.
No, I have chapters I'm writing, but I don't have a book.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. The website, by the way, again, is walkable.org, just simply www.walkable.org. We're at our midpoint here. Let me mention again that Dan Burden will be speaking tonight in Champaign-Urbana at the Illinois Terminal Building, which is 45 East University. That's the headquarters of the NTD here. That's a public presentation from 7 to 8 o'clock tonight on walkable communities, and that's free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. He's also giving a more extended workshop Friday and Saturday that does require some registration. You can contact the MTD. This is a workshop, I understand. It's not just for professionals. It's for anyone who's really interested in doing something about this.
Well, you know, in fact, that's part of my message, is we've got to stop having specialists learn all the skills and just going off and doing what they do. We need many, many generalists, people who see the broad picture. I am not a specialist. I have no specific training in engineering, planning, architecture, landscape architecture. What I do is I listen to all of the professions, and by not having the sets of blinders on that they've gotten from their college training, I see a broader picture. And so I might break a classic rule in engineering, but we end up with something better. And I think what we're finding is some of the best decisions ever made in the direction of our country have been made by people who are generalists, people like Jane Jacobs. She broke all the rules in planning by not having been a planner.
Very interesting. Well, our lines are pretty full here, so let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Very interesting program. I think you mentioned two books or two cities that were involved in planning these walkable communities. Would you tell us what that is, those are again?
Sacramento, California, which I absolutely love. It's a big city that has a lot of challenges, and they're working together. The second is Charlotte, North Carolina. Again, a very large city that's just making incredible decisions. For example, now they're building their new light rail. The first of four lines they're going to build, and they're building seven villages out of urban sprawl where each of those light rail stations will be.
Okay, seven villages out of the urban sprawl in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Along the rail line.
Oh, along rail line.
A light rail, light rail.
Along what?
A light rail. They're installing light rail.
Light rail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and where is your workshop going to be on this weekend?
It's also at the Illinois Terminal Building, which is, yeah, if you know where that is, it's the new MTD terminal.
And what time is it going to be this weekend?
I think, let's see, registration begins tomorrow at 7:30. It starts at 8, and it goes basically all day. And then on Saturday from 8 to noon, I think is that. I've got the schedule here. It's actually advertised in the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette.
Okay.
That's how I found out about it.
Yeah, and you can come and go. You don't need to be there the whole day.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you'd like, I'll give you the phone number, too, for the MTD, 384-8188.
384-8188.
Yeah, and you can call there for reservations.
For information. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Before we get on to the next caller, you've mentioned light rail a couple of times, and that's something that has been sort of raised here in this community as something that, you know, the MTD, I think, was studying light rail as a way to sort of transform public transportation and other things about this community. And then the price tag was mentioned, and everybody went, what, are you nuts?
Yeah. It's usually somewhere above $40 million a mile. It's off the charts expensive. There are many other systems, many other ways to go. Honolulu, for example, is investing in what's called BRT, Bus Rapid Transit. They still use vehicles that look like buses, although they're better than buses, and they use stations. And the good news is, because they're rubber tired, they can move the stations if they need to make some adjustments. But they're very efficient, very powerful, and just a fraction of the cost. And there's some other systems that are very in keeping with college communities that can get down to as little as $1 million a mile and still be rail-oriented. The Japanese have been developing this, and we've got some developers in Florida who have been looking into these. We call them greenways. They share bike routes with a very a small rail, and the kind of cars you just literally slide onto. There's no aisle or anything, so they make them very efficient. They run with Briggs & Stratton engines that generates the electric power for these. They're very quiet, and they match beautifully with a trail.
You mentioned the installation of stations for these buses. How key is that?
Well, I think it's important to have real focal points for collection and to have the great efficiencies, you know, so you'd have a new station every half mile. That's the perfect spacing. That's the way trolley cars were laid out.
Half mile.
Half mile. Mm-hmm. And that gives you a quarter-mile village, the boundary, and then the next quarter mile village. And by doing that, we keep very high efficiencies with moving the vehicular loads, and then, of course, for people to walk into. And then we can put a little bit of money into the stations and make them civic spaces and have great retail sprout out from that. In fact, one of the neat things about Portland with their light rail system, you cannot pay for light rail at the fare box. It just can't happen. And but what they're finding is everywhere they put in a light rail station, they make mega millions of dollars off of the development. So it's a form of community development that pays huge dividends to the tax base, to the building of communities and so on, by investing around transit stations.
Very good. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll get next to a listener in Belgium, line number 2. Good morning.
Yes, I totally agree with your ideas. The unfortunate thing is, and why you say it's going to be slow in the Midwest, we're somewhat isolated in our communities. They're dotted around because of the rail system that first brought a lot of people here. But there's small towns, especially in central Illinois, central Indiana. It's difficult to set up a relationship between these towns in any kind of bicycle walking type of endeavor. Hello?
Yes. Yes. Well, and you're right. And, you know, once we killed off the trains in our country, we basically were giving a death blow to all these wonderful little towns and making them totally car dependent.
I agree.
And I think eventually we're going to figure it out. We're going to figure out how to get some rail back. And it won't be the same rail that we had before. But I think truly the way that we can move people by something other than the private auto car is what's really going to revitalize all of our wonderful little towns. And I'm not going to give up on the Midwest. I think it's going to make it. But at the same time, until people realize that they have a choice and can switch to other modes of transportation and work together so that they can build it in their own community, each of those towns is going to continue to decay a little bit and destroy itself in ways that we'll regret.
And I'd like to also suggest that I think the place that you need to start with this concept is maybe in grade school. Teach children to walk more, to get out and enjoy that aspect of activity so that they'd want these kind of spaces.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was speaking with someone yesterday and talking about the importance of teaching people how to live without a car. And, you know, everything we have focused on is by the time you're 16 – you've been a slave to your parents and any way, and so it's like finally you get this right to a passage. And what I was thinking is, you know, we need to be able to offer a course to those who want to take it on how to live without a car. I never had a car until I was 35. Didn't want one, didn't need one, and lived many places very successfully. But there's a skill in living without a car, and a lot of people don't know what that skill is.
That's interesting.
I don't. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Well, there's a couple things to follow up on there. You know, I'm thinking about the University of Illinois campus, which is a great place. It's a great place to walk around in, and I think they're doing some great things to make it even better. But the thing is, you know, there are no grocery stores on campus at all. There are none. I mean, there's no way to actually go shopping for food on campus.
Yeah. The great towns in America that are becoming walkable are learning that you cannot have a grocery store larger than 20,000 square feet, maybe 25,000. By building the 60 and 80,000 square foot grocery stores, what we're saying is we're only going to have one every 6 miles or every 2 miles, and that's totally unwalkable. So until we learn how to build small, very well stocked 20 or 25,000 square foot groceries, we really can't have walkability. It's going to require some new industries, some new ways of looking at conventional stores, stores that are the right size, the right place, that carry the right products so that people can live independent and have affordable prices without having to go to the mega store.
The other thing the caller mentioned was, you know, the issue of, you know, the small town sort of isolated. There was a time in the early part of the 20th century when there was a light rail system, you may already know this, that existed in Champaign-Urbana that connected, I believe, as far west as Clinton, which is about 30 miles west of here, and as far east as Homer, and maybe even beyond that. And people would take that light rail system to go to various parks and to go from community to community, and it was very convenient and very effective. And, of course, the automobile came along and basically killed that.
Yeah. I think if Henry Ford were alive today, or any of the early giants in starting the auto industry, if they had realized what we would have done with their inventions, they would not have gone further forward. One of Henry Ford's quests was to allow people to go out and picnic in the countryside. He didn't want to destroy the countryside. Obviously, if we did that by the light rail or trolley stations, it worked, and it worked well. We developed some really great parks out these distances. We got to the beach by trolley and things like that. I'm convinced that if through some quirk in history we had waited 30 more years for the car, America would be the greatest nation for livability. But it was that 30-year jump with technology and mass production of the car, and then, of course, post-World War II, building the interstate systems and building the factory housing and literally making it impossible for a returning GI to invest in a home in the center city. You could only get a loan to buy the factory houses further out of town.
And that was by design.
By design.
Yeah.
And to this day, the mortgage rules basically still favor sprawl. And so do the realtors. That's how they've been trained, to sell those homes. And the developer that wants to build a great mixed-use concept and do good quality urban infill is breaking every rule. They can't find the bankers that know how to work together. One works in commerce. Another one works in residential. They don't speak the same language. So everything we now need to do has to break all the institutional rules and start from scratch.
Interesting. A couple other calls waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning.
Yeah, this is a great topic. I just read a news report about a study out of the University of Pittsburgh, which is being reported in the American Journal of Health Promotion, which says that the walkability of a neighborhood determines the activity level of older women. And since they're the least active group, the health benefits are really tremendous. So I guess, dang, it gets in my question, though. I guess that would mean we'd have to spend less money on health care. What do you have to say about the economic benefits of making a place walkable? For example, I'm wondering if you could make this I could tie this into a question about Orlando, Florida. I happen to have relatives in the area, and I just read that Orlando, Florida is one of the worst in the country. It has very high pedestrian fatalities. And is there any way you could talk about, maybe in talking in terms of Orlando, what the economic effects are? I mean, there's a place where they deliberately made the place not walkable, it seems. Are they suffering because of that? And are places that are making their place more walkable, what are the economic effects?
Right. A couple of new studies out that show that sprawl is in direct correlation with the levels of quality of people's health. The more sprawl, the more we decline our health. And obviously, as we don't get the exercise, as we put on the extra body fat, we end up with much higher levels of heart problems, respiratory, diabetes. Every serious disease you can think of, including cancer, goes up as we put on the extra weight. The weight is obviously a product of both bad food, way too fatty, way too many calories, and just not getting the exercise to burn that stuff off. A year ago, I weighed 50 pounds more than I do today. I came down with diabetes. I'll have it the rest of my life. I'm reasonably trim now, and I project I'm going to live longer than most people because I'm now carefully watching over my calorie intake and expenditure. But so many people, and Florida's a good example, Orlando, of where everything was built post-auto, and where it's going to be very hard to build in walkability. Now, we're doing it. We have to. And Florida is truly the national leader in new urbanism, in building new communities, new neighborhoods that are truly walkable. Great trees and great streets and good mixed-use development in many locations. But it's going to be a battle, and it's truly a battle for health. And I'd like to say it's also going to be a battle of affordability, that our health care costs are totally related to how much exercise we as Americans are getting.
Very interesting.
So you can't like compare Seattle to Orlando and say, you know, filter out all the other factors and say because Seattle's walkable, it's more economic in any way.
Well, what we can say is that when people fall in love with the lifestyles they can have in a place like Seattle, where they can be very active, that attracts jobs. And even during the hard-hit times right now, the recessions with the airline industries and Boeing and all the others, people still want to move to Seattle. And they're not flocking to the places that are unhealthy, that are not livable. In fact, so many personal stories and corporate stories of people wanting to take their corporations where their senior managers and middle managers are willing to live. And if a place is not livable, it doesn't matter what tax offerings we give. You know, you can only induce a person so long to make that expenditure if they're not going to be able to retain their key employees. They want livability. And that's one reason places like Portland, Seattle, San Diego, all kinds of places in the West that have focused on livability are still continuing to attract good businesses.
Hope the caller will forgive me for moving on. We only have about 6 or 7 minutes left, and we have another caller waiting. And probably time for another call if you'd like to join us. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I just moved up to Chicago from Champaign-Urbana, and I like the neighborhood I live in a lot. I don't think all of Chicago is like this, but I can walk right down the street and get my groceries. There's a hardware store not too far. There's an L stop, and, you know, buses are all over. And as much as I love Champaign-Urbana, there certainly is, like, you can get everywhere on bike totally easy, but I think walking is a little bit different because there are no neighborhood grocery stores. And even at one point in, I think it was like quite a while ago, almost 10 years ago, but there was a little neighborhood bar up sort of where I used to live. And, you know, it wasn't a bad bar. They sold candy to the kids as we were coming home from school, and there was a hair salon right next to it, and I think a photo place as well.
Talking about Huber's, of course.
Huber's.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. And they were talking about shutting it down. Now, it didn't happen. But so that was like the only sort of business in that whole area. The only places you'd go, like west of Madison, it'd be entirely strip malls and things like that where you would go shopping or whatnot. And I don't know. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on like how Champaign-Urbana can like reverse that trend and get like small businesses back into neighborhoods where people don't have to walk to like Schnucks or, you know, big places like that to get their groceries or what they need.
Yeah, I think the formula is fairly simple. It's a matter of getting a good leadership group together and start on one model area, a neighborhood that gets it, that has some ability to transform. And by the way, every neighborhood has that ability. Mm. And to get a declaration of support from all the right players, you know, all the elected leaders, the planning commissions, the school board members, the fire department, the police department, everybody who has a role to play to take part and to help shape that vision, and then to have the political will and commitment to start to put some dollars into reformatting some of the streets, proving to the developers that this is the good place to invest, training the good developers to come and work, and give them certain partnering opportunities so that you can prove that economically the developers make better money when they start to invest in things like mixed-use retail and multi-story buildings and things like that.
We're in neighborhoods, some neighborhoods are already, like, completely built up with houses. Like, where would you find the space to put these things in places like that?
Well, it depends on how well the homes were built, whether they're historic or not. Even the best, most dense historic neighborhoods have development opportunities or redevelopment opportunities. The main thing is on important intersections or a focal point, quite often the buildings are not worth near as much as the land. And it's possible to rebuild those buildings, offer to the people who trade out their buildings, in some cases houses, the first opportunity to move into the great new house with the retail down below and all the services that are right there. But again, that's why it requires a neighborhood vision. People have to work together on this and have to decide where is the right and the best location. But I, you know, without having spent more than a few minutes getting to this radio station, I can guarantee you there are dozens and dozens of great opportunities right here for people to start to make those investments.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. It really is a great community. I think that I have a feeling you'll have a receptive audience in the workshops. There's one other issue I wanted to touch on briefly, and that is, you know, you talked about mixed uses. I wonder if it's also important to create community focal points you know, that have mixed income groups, mixed ages, mixed races, et cetera. Is that part of this as well?
Oh, it's absolutely essential. We have devastated ourselves by sending all the grandparents off to one place, or older people can live here, and families can live here, and if you're below a certain economic level, you get to live over there and things like that. The best neighborhoods throughout the history of the world have always been mixed income and so on. And it's the only way that we'll grow up culturally, that we'll start to lose some of our fear. And so, again, one of the reasons I love Charlotte is they took one of their four major downtown area neighborhoods. They had to bulldoze a lot of it. It was bad stuff. And there was a lot of crime and a lot of prostitution and drugs and all kinds of stuff. They kept some of the buildings and rebuilt those, and then built brand new streets, brand new buildings, brand new school, brand new park, and made it the desirable place to live, and invited everybody to stay there if they wanted to. Some chose not to. Mm-hmm. And obviously now rich diversity ethnically, economically. The new homes now being built are coming in somewhere around $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. It's a place that had been totally devastated economically, and it's just wonderful. And just an example of what can and should and must occur as we build these villages.
But in those the same place where you have the $300,000-$400,000 houses, there are also some opportunities for lower income people to live as well.
Cottages and many times what we refer to as granny flats, mm-hmm. or studios above the garage. Mm-hmm. It's extra income for the people in the big house. And maybe at some point in their lives, they'll say, hey, wait a minute, I need the extra income. I'm going to live in the granny flat. I've designed it so that I'm going to feel comfortable there. And I'm going to rent out the big house. I'm going to have a pretty good income to do travel with and things like that.
Well, we're going to have to stop since we're out of time. We have scratched the surface of the topic. But if you would like to learn more, you are invited to a public presentation tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illinois Terminal Building in Champaign, 45 East University. Also, a more extensive workshop tomorrow and Saturday that is being sponsored by the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District, the City of Urbana, and the City of Champaign. If you'd like more information, you can call the MTD at 384-8188. Our guest has been Dan Burden. And, Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. Today's broadcast is made possible with support.